So just before the talk now, I thought yesterday, my talk could be called Sighting the Bird, or putting out breadcrumbs for the bird, or just acknowledging that there's a bird. There's a bird. You may not know that there is one, but there is one. And then today, I thought, because I want to keep exploring. The thought that came was, today is maybe painting the bird and freeing the bird. And it occurred to me that we paint the bird with our breath, and we free the bird with our breath. In that way, actually, the bird and our breath, the bird and our zazen, is same thing. The bird and us are same thing. And the more I... Does that make some sense to you? The more I... The more I think about what seems really what we need, and I, to say think about it doesn't really even cover it. The more I really try to plunge into what do I really think we need, way beyond thinking, I'm certain that our relationship to our inmost request and developing a disciplined practice to maintain that relationship as whole, wholly as possible. W-H-O-L. L-Y. I had to go to my school days. But, you know, having that relationship and maintaining it with a disciplined practice to really maintain it, really provides us with what I think of as a kind of freeing tether that helps us keep our direction throughout our life. And when I say freeing tether, it may sound like an oxymoron, right? Because we think of a tether as something that kind of, you know, holds you back. But in using that phrase, freeing tether, what I'm really trying to do is I'm trying to acknowledge, to name, to emphasize the liberating function of discipline. You know, in the Sandokai we say each thing has its own virtue, right? So that's what I said yesterday. There's a liberating function that following our awareness, right, discipline, obedience to awareness, there's a liberating function that I think we really need to name and really... name it as a way of really appreciating it so that we can cultivate it. Discipline does that for us. Life doesn't come to us in some sort of vague, non-specific way. You know, not, life comes to us in a very detailed way. This happens and that doesn't happen. This takes place and that doesn't take place. This person is sick, that person dies, that person's playing baseball, that person fell in love, that person fell out of love. This wall fell on that car. There's nothing vague about this. Life happens in its details, and we even have this terrible phrase, right? The devil is in the details. Well, actually, the devil's not in the details. The details are just the details. The devil is something we make about the details as a way of telling us ourselves a story about it. But because it comes to us in the details, having a discipline that's connected to that deep inmost request can really help us with our lives. And I tried to say this in one of those short poems in my book, 100 Butterflies. Once inside the bamboo tube, the snake learns a new way. That's the liberating function of discipline. That bamboo tube. You know, the snake goes... But once inside... it's the snake doesn't have to be constricted. It can actually discover its freedom. Do you know who one of the great models of that is in our lifetime? Nelson Mandela. That beautiful man who never let his being be imprisoned, though they held him in a cage. Who came out freer than when he went in, and who showed us what a human being can do inside a bamboo tube. I'm so grateful to know about his life. So it's like this raksu of mine right here. I can't really getting away from knowing that I have made a vow, because I'm wearing my vow right here. And that vow has given me the life that I want. And the truth is that I don't really want to get away from knowing it. I don't feel burdened by this. I feel freed by it. Because the vow reminds me that I have certain things that I said I'm going to do, and I want to do those things. No one made me take those vows. No one made, those of you who have taken your precepts and vows, no one forced you to do that. My guess is your inmost request said, please, help me emerge into the world by doing this. This is a freeing tether for me. Can't really pull away. And I've told you this before, but once when I was driving, Shirley and I were driving, and somebody cut me off, and Shirley just felt my foot hit the accelerator. And all she said was, Peter, remember your vows. And my foot went off the accelerator. Smart woman. She didn't have to say, what are you doing, road rage, it's just remember your vows. That's it. That's the tether. And that's how it's freeing. And the discipline and the care that taking these vows or saying, I'm going to live in a certain way, I'm going to move into a certain direction, has really, you know, what it does is it's helped me to fulfill and nourish my inmost request. Because my inmost request wasn't to be the fastest driver on the road. My inmost request was to save all beings. Was to know the wholeness of life that included all beings in a way so that I might be of some small help in this world. So I know that in naming it and inviting our inmost request to emerge, the thinking mind, it's not like it's not there. It's listening. And it can turn that, what is my inmost request or what is my deepest thing? You can turn that into a kind of koan. And we can think and think and think and think and think. And we can get distracted all day long thinking about it. Right? We can really get kind of caught and lost. Because the thinking mind that's connected to the ego has a certain demand made by the ego. And the demand made by the ego is, how do I do it? I want to get it right so I can feel good. And in fact, just, what is today, Saturday? So just Thursday, I got an email from a Zen teacher saying that she was trying to find the solution. And she finally realized that her desire to find the solution was making her sick. This is someone who's practiced for 40 plus years. So it's not like this kind of mind goes away. We always have to deal with it. But that ego demand to get it right, to find the solution, to name it, to kind of push at that in that way, is really, it can't be satisfied in the usual way. There's no mechanistic response. It's not a, you know, true false question on an exam or anything like that. You say, okay, if I just do this and I just do that, then guaranteed, you know, voila, I got it. I've got my inmost request. That's not how it works. And that's why I spent the time talking about developing the relationship and being sensitive and subtle with it yesterday when I was describing the bird. The invitation that we give ourselves to allow our inmost request to emerge is really just, in its simplest terms, it's just a chance for us to clarify our mind, to let our mind become clear. so that there's plenty of room for that inmost request, not just to emerge, but to take up residence in that mind that's not so crowded with all this other crazy stuff that we do on a regular basis, whether you've been practicing for 1 minute or 45 years. It doesn't make any difference, really. And we want to clarify the mind because, in essence, it will help us to clarify the question of who am I, really? What is this life, really? So that we can live the way life wants to live, unhindered by its opinions about itself. The grass, the trees, the flowers, the birds, they all know how to do this naturally. They're not... they may have hindrances, but it's not the one that I'm talking about. So we want to clarify the mind, but I think it's a reasonable question for us to ask, you know, how do I clarify the mind so that I can, in Zen we say, clarify the great matter of birth and death. How can I clarify this? Birth and death is a hyphenate, like birth, hyphen, and hyphen, death, hyphen. One thing. It's not birth here, death there. It's just this. It's all included. It comes with the car. It's part of the standard equipment. You don't have to pay extra for these options. There are no options. You're born, you're going to die. That's the way it is. So, of course, you know, our major practice for clarifying the great matter of clarifying the mind is shikantaza, is zazen, is meditation. The disciplined and wholehearted just sitting that Dogen calls practice realization. That's how we do it in this form, in this practice. So we just sit. You know, where just means full engagement, like in the poem, in my discussion of William Carlos Williams yesterday. Just means shikan, means complete, nothing left out, no gap, complete, full engagement in our practice. So, but then we get another question, which is, okay, well, how do I do that? Okay, I want to clarify the mind, okay. Just sit, okay. How do I just sit? See, again, the grass doesn't have this problem. It knows how to grow and die, easy. And in Shobo Genzo, Dogen's life work, as many of you know, there's this wonderful passage that addresses this. Yaoshan, a great master Hongdao, was sitting. And a monk asked him, it's kind of funny actually, right? So here's great master, you know, Yaoshan, great master Hongdao, is sitting. And a monk comes up and says, hey, can I talk to you for a minute? I think that's pretty good, actually. So Yaoshan is just sitting, and a monk says to him, in steadfast sitting, what do you think? Steadfast is a very important word here. Steadfast is shikan, right? Unwavering sitting. So the monk says, in steadfast sitting, what do you think? Yaoshan said, think not thinking. The monk said, how do you think not thinking? And Yaoshan replied, beyond thinking. This is a really great and instructive passage for us. What's interesting to me when I thought about including it in my talk was that think not thinking is very much like William Carlos Williams saying the poet thinks with the poem, and that in itself is the profundity, right? It's not thinking about. It's total immersion. It's the profundity is in the fullness of the act itself. So that's what Yaoshan is saying. If you want to know what you think in steadfast, disciplined, complete sitting, it's total immersion. 100%. So shikan means fully engage. It means exactly the same thing. So the instruction is right there in our practice. So what do you think? Oh, think not thinking. Not thinking. It's full engagement. How do you fully engage, right? How do you think not thinking? Beyond thinking. How do you go beyond thinking? Think not thinking. That's the only way to do it. And Dogen says, this is the thorough study of steadfast sitting transmitted in the Buddha way. So the thorough study of steadfast sitting is steadfast sitting. It's not something else. There's no way to get to it. There's the doing it itself. So again, this point gets made over and over again. And in Shobogenzo, the first chapter is Bendoa. Bendoa is, we translate it, it's on the endeavor of the way. And Dogen does us a favor. He predicts that people are going to want to know about our practice, about Zazen. So he asks himself a bunch of questions and then he answers them. He has this sort of pretend dialogue with interested parties, which is us. And again, he did it because he knew people would want to know what his understanding was. And in Bendoa, Dogen says very strongly that Zazen is the front gate. Right? Our meditation practice. It's the front gate for the Buddha Dharma. And that that sitting Zazen is not just uselessly sitting around doing nothing. So he wants to really tell us what it is. And so here's this interesting exchange he had with himself for our benefit. This is Dogen talking to himself, knowing that we were listening. So question one. We have heard now that the merit of Zazen is lofty and great. But an ignorant person may be doubtful and say, there are many gates for Buddha Dharma. Why do you recommend Zazen exclusively? Dogen says, because this is the front gate for Buddha Dharma. So the questioner says, well, why do you regard Zazen alone as the front gate? And the answer is, the great master Shakyamuni authentically transmitted this splendid method of attaining the way. And all Buddha Tathagatas of the past, future, and the present attain the way by practicing Zazen. For this reason, it has been transmitted as the front gate. Furthermore, all ancestors in India and China attained the way by practicing Zazen. Thus, I now teach this front gate to human beings and to devas, gods. They may want to know. Questioner continues, we understand that you have studied the path of the Buddha ancestors and authentically transmit the Tathagata's excellent art. This is beyond the reach of ordinary thought. However, reading sutras or chanting Buddha's name must be causes and conditions of enlightenment. How can Zazen, just sitting uselessly doing nothing, being depended upon for attaining enlightenment? Dogen's reply is long, so I excerpted. If you think that the samadhi of all Buddhas, their unsurpassable great art, is just sitting uselessly doing nothing, you malign the great vehicle. Such misunderstanding is like saying there is no water when you are in the middle of the ocean. Just now, all Buddhas sit serenely at ease in receptive samadhi. And it's an important line because it means when we sit in receptive samadhi, all Buddhas are there because we cannot separate ourselves from them. What a pity that your eye is not open, that your mind is still intoxicated. And when he says intoxicated, he means it's sort of trapped by, you know, conceptual thinking or intellectual ideas, not rooted in the actual practice of Zazen. He goes on, the realm of all Buddhas is inconceivable. It cannot be reached by intellect, much less by those who have no trust or who lack wisdom. They cannot know it. Only those who have the great capacity of genuine trust can enter this realm. Those who have no trust are unable to accept it, however much they hear it. And this is a very interesting passage to me. Because he's saying that trust in the practice, like I was saying yesterday, faith of, right? That trust in the practice itself, not trust in anything you can't see, but what you're actually doing. Trust in genuine trust, and using our great capacity of genuine trust, because our capacity is very large. It's very big. And so he's calling on us, test it out. Trust it, find out, test it out. And if you really think about it, what happens when we're sitting in Zazen? We're letting go. We're not knowing. We're not relying on our usual crutch of intellectual thinking and concepts and ideas and our notions about the world. We're letting go of all of that. And that takes trust. And it takes a great amount of courage to let go. And so Dogen is really emphasizing that. If we have the courage to trust and throw ourselves, plunge ourselves completely and fully engage the practice of Shikantaza, the practice of Zazen, we have a chance to enter the realm of reality, the realm of the Buddha Dharma, which the teachings talk about. Dogen says, when genuine trust arises, practice and study with the teacher. And if it does not, wait for a while. Just like Jacques Prévert says. Right? The swiftness or slowness of the coming of the bird has no relationship to the success of the picture. It's the same thing. Dogen and Prévert, they're writing the same poem of our lives. Dogen goes on, I'll stop after. He says, just understand that when a master who has attained the way with a clear mind authentically transmits, shares it with a student who has merged with realization, then the wondrous dharma of the seven original Buddhas in its essence is actualized and maintained. This cannot be known by those who only study words. Therefore, set aside your doubt, practice Zazen, and actualize Buddha's receptive samadhi. He's very clear about this path. He's pretty direct, don't you think? He even said at one point, I cut it out, but he said, how can repetitively chanting the Buddha's name like a bunch of croaking frogs? You know, so he's arguing against some other schools of Buddhism. You know, help you realize the Buddha Dharma. I don't know, maybe we could try it. It's not bad. I think, you know, one of the things that's in the passage that I like is he says that Zazen is the front gate of the Buddha Dharma. So if there's a front gate, is there a back gate? I think if we were to ask Dogen if there's a back gate, he'd say, yeah, it's Zazen. And if there's a front gate and a back gate, where do these gates lead? I mean, exactly where are we going? You know, is there some kind of like magical, like members only VIP land that you you get to go into? Dogen is saying that to enter this gate, all we really need is trust. The willingness to, as we say in Zen, leap off the 100-foot pole. What is that 100-foot pole? It's this strong tower that of certainty of our ideas, of what we've decided about the world. And Dogen is saying, leap off, enter the front gate through Zazen. All that certainty in the end not only may not help you, but it may hurt you. Let go. Find out what your life really is. Enter the front gate. In Zen practices, I think as many of you know, that that all gates to the Buddha Dharma are referred to as gateless gates. And the famous koan collection, the Mumongan. Mu means no. Mon, no gate. Gone. So no gate, the gateless gate. That's what the koan collection is called. You know, and that's how it's discussed. So it's a gate that's gateless. And it would seem no problem. We can just walk it through. But maybe it's not so easy. And just like in Prevert's poem, we have to paint the bird. And we have to paint the bars out. We have to do something. So we have to make some kind of effort to go through this gateless gate. But when we make the effort, if we make the effort in our usual way, with expectation and goals in sight, then, to answer your question, Melanie, then the painting is bad. The bird is not going to fly. So we have to enter the gate in a different way. And maybe that's why I heard we paint the bird and we paint and we free the bird with the breath. I think that's what Dogen is saying. And another one of those short poems in the 100 Butterfly book is an open gate, an empty field. Who goes through? So that's the challenge right there. An open gate, empty field. Who goes through? You know, I'm just kind of like what the Dogen would call, I'm just twiddling the subject in my fingers here by using these words. But I'm just pointing to something that is really an established reality in the Buddha Dharma, which is that all of this is just pointing to what we say is a jewel sewn into the back of our robes. In the Buddha Dharma, we are told, you have a jewel sewn into the back of your robes. And you are living like a poor person, but you actually have a treasure. That treasure is a bright pearl. And it's the bright pearl of our own wholeness, our own true self, our own original nature. And we're all carrying it around with ourselves. And we can discover that pearl wed to our inmost request and with the kind of discipline practice that I've been speaking of. I think that we have to admit that deep down we want to clarify the mind. We want to know this because we suffer and because we look around and we see nothing but suffering all around us. And becoming with our inmost request, becoming one with it, and practicing sitting in this Buddha way can help us to enter the front gate and clarify the mind. And this is a primary understanding, that when we do so, the mind settles down. It just settles down and returns to itself. What Suzuki Roshi used to call returning, he calls Zazen regaining our natural composure. We have a natural composure. And the practice, which takes effort, and I know that you're tired, and I know that you get activated and reactive and all the stuff we all do, everybody does. But this is actually the path through which we regain our natural composure. Because all that other stuff can slide away. And we can find that we're actually there. So I think of our practice like maybe a warm sun. Just a warm sun. Shining on a foggy or a misty mirror. And in time, because of the warmth of the sun, because of the light, because of the illumination of the sun, that fog and that mist dissipates. It evaporates. And then the mirror becomes quite clear. And then as Sonsenim, the Korean master that some of us used to like to sit with, he would say, then when there's a blue sky, you see a blue sky. And when somebody need something, you know what to do. And that's so wonderful. When there's a blue sky, we see a blue sky. And when someone needs something, we know they need something, and we know what to do. Because the mind has been clarified. Because the fog is lifted off the mirror. So, that's the good news. Here's the hard news. Sorry. The truth is that this practice is a wonderful practice, life-giving practice, life-nourishing practice. But it does not cure the fact of old age, sickness, and death. And, you know, we live in the time of the so-called magic bullet, right? Gotta be a way to out of this, but there's no way out. I guess unless you die young, but there's no way out of old age, sickness, and death. In other words, there's no way out of the rigors of living, the difficulties of living. And so, you know, we can ask, well, why do we do it? Really? There's no cure. And I think that, you know, an honest reply is that when we sit zazen, and when we stay in touch with our inmost request more and more and more, as much as possible, and the mind clarifies through this very, you know, humble, modest, but noble practice, we're better able to meet life's difficulties. We're better able to meet old age. We're better able to meet illness. And we're better able to meet death. It's not that, you know, if that's what is served up to us, if those are the challenges that we're given, we're better able to meet the challenges. The challenges don't change, but we change. And that's the key. And because we change, there are fewer challenges. And what seemed like possibly, unsurmountable challenges become maybe just challenges. Again, nothing is cured. But things are met in a way that is about as good as it possibly gets. And, you know, as we know from our Sangha, old age, sickness, and death will come to call. And so we have a way to meet it. I think it's worthwhile asking, so what is it really that prevents us from just, you know, like a Ben asked, you know, what's the quick way for me to, what was it, like, know my inmost request or something like that, right? What's the quick way? What is it that's in the way of that? Why can't we just do it? And I think you know that the answer to that is well known. It's called the first ennobling truth, or the first noble truth in the Buddha Dharma. Life is difficult, and the second truth is because of our attachments and our aversions. We put all of that in between us and us. And we do it regularly. We're not bad for doing it. It's quite normal to do it. And so I want to end my talk just, I want to talk about attachment for a minute. Because attachment has been given a very bad word, a very bad name. And, you know, I've said this to you before. Can you imagine if someone came into the Dogasan room and said, I have three kids, I don't care about any of them. I'm not attached to anyone. And expecting me to say, oh, that's just so wonderful. How great for the world. We need to know that we do have attachments. And we do have to work with our attachments. But they are not the enemy. It's a mistake to think of them as an enemy. Because it means you're making part of your natural part of your psyche an enemy of yourself. And so I want to say this kind of strongly. If you... In studying the Abhidharma, text from long ago, our attachments arise naturally as part of our human inheritance. They're part of human existence. And from birth, and even from conception, as I understand it, and as the Abhidharma describes it, we want to live, right? Life wants to live. We want to be we want to be comfortable. We don't want to hurt. We want to be comforted if we are hurt. And we want our bodies and our minds to be nourished in a way that is good for life. If you think about what I just said to you, now think about the Metta Sutra. Think about what we say in Metta practice. May I be happy and free from suffering. May I be well. May I be safe. May I be peaceful and at ease. Well, guess what? That's what we want naturally. And so we form kinds of attachments to try to arrange that as part of our natural growth. We actually are trying to live the Metta Sutra as part of our natural life. And that means we form certain kinds of attachments that help to build a healthy self. And that healthy self includes a healthy ego. Doesn't that make sense to you? We want a healthy body and mind. And there are certain things that we get attached to help do that, and we do it as a matter of our human nature. So we can't just say, out of hand, oh yeah, all attachments are bad. That's actually not true. The problem comes in when the egoic drive becomes out of balance to the overall health of the body and mind. And the hungry ghost, the part of us that can never be satisfied or that has to have things a certain way and refuses to have things another way, that has very powerful preferences, that it's got to be my way or the highway, that, all of a sudden, the whole life goes on tilt because the egoic attachments, that phrase, he's got a big head, right? They get a big head. They get too strong. And that undoes the body's the body and mind's ability to naturally balance itself as a whole and healthy life. So it's not the attachment, the fact of attachments, that's the problem. It's whether or not the attachments have run away with us and are harming the body and mind in its wholeness as itself. So one of the ways we can talk about that in the Buddha Dharma is to say that karmic life, so life of karma is the life of, our action and reaction and what all of that creates. It's kind of the life of delusion that serves only the ego and not the body, mind as a whole being. Is when karmic life overtakes dharmic life. Dharmic life can be seen as the life of reality. That karmic life is not the life of reality. A lot of people say to us, come on, get real. And then they tell you to do something that, will end up destroying something else. Come on, get real. Everybody, needs three cars. Don't you know that? So we have to find the balance between karmic life and dharmic life, and nourishing our inmost request and having the discipline to allow that to guide us is the best way for that to happen, in my understanding. Once we understand that freeing tether brings us back away from being controlled by a karmic life, then the discipline of our practice becomes more easy because we can see the liberating function of that discipline. It's really that simple. And the suffering caused by an out-of-balance ego can come to an end. This is part of what Dogen called practice realization. In the practice, the realization becomes more and more real. The dharmic life becomes more and more the given of what our lives are all about. And the karmic life is not hated, it's used as food. We eat it. We turn it into nourishment for awakening, or nourishment for enlightenment, nourishment for wholeness, so that we can be of some use to the world. And that's why we're here at Sesshin. We're touching and freeing and being touched by and being freed by this clarified true mind, which is our natural inheritance. One that we can give to the world. So thank you.